I am heart sick at the bloody and tragic history which we are helping to write in Vietnam. Last week, there are over 7,500 casualties, dead and wounded, soldiers, civilians, adults, children. The war grows apace. Fury, violence, murderous, and its murderous quality. Secretary General U Thant said Wednesday last at his press conference that each week the war moves ahead, death and destruction and consequent misery, and that the pace seems to be increasing week by week. What was once called a nasty little war has become that most terrible of all wars, a war of attrition. Vietnam has become a hunt, and there is no limit to the human bag. After every skirmish and every battle, men very carefully take on that ghastly and ghoulish task of counting the corpses. Because the unbelievable standard of our success in Vietnam is what is called the kill ratio. The number of enemy dead to our own. And for what salve it can offer the American people, that ratio stands now at 5.6 to 1. It seems that we have reverted to the primitivism of the frontier, where men notched their victims on the butt of their pistols, and when the appropriateness and the rightness of any action was measured by the speed of your draw and the accuracy of your shooting. Vietnam has become a shoot. Except that the prey, the game, is not partridge or grouse or rabbits, but men. And they can shoot back. Not with the same jet planes and technical weaponry that you have, but very effectively with machine guns, mortars, and in hand-to-hand combat with their machetes. It's a dangerous sport and a murderous one. I read recently the report of a small town newspaper editor from Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And in this vignette, which he entitled Winning Hearts in Vietnam, you catch the flavor and the folly and the immorality of that battle. The reconnaissance plane skimmed across the village at treetop level. Standing knee-deep in the rice fields, the farmers looked up from their work, tipped their white conical hats forward, and reflecting angry surprise at the small silver plane roaring by just above them. Then a shot sounded from behind the plane, a loud crack easily heard through the wind rushing by the open windows. Pressing the intercom button, I called to the pilot, "Somebody's shooting at us." He too had heard the shot and was pulling back on the stick, sending the single engine plane into a steep climb. "You see where that came from?" "No idea." It was indeed impossible to tell where the sniper was located. He might have fired from one of the small thatched huts in the village, or he might have been concealed in one of the many tree lines which had flashed by as we buzzed the area. "I sure don't like getting shot at," the pilot muttered. Then, almost as an afterthought, "I wonder whether to call an airstrike on that village." Until the shot was fired, it had been a routine mission. We had flown down the coast looking for enemy troop movements or suspicious constructions that might signal a new Viet Cong bunker or trench system. Many of the villages had recently been burned out by the troops operating in the area. The huts were little more than black skeletons of bamboo sticks protruding lifelessly into the sky. The trees and shrubbery were scorched brown and gray. Endless parallel tracks interlaced among the fields and into the villages showed where tanks and armored personnel carriers had smashed and plowed their way through the area. The green rice stalks, ready for harvesting, rippled in the breeze like a field of rich Iowa wheat. However, the fields were not being harvested. The peasants had scattered for the mountains or to the teeming refugee camps miles to the north. The area had been designated a fire-free zone, where anything that moved was fair game for troops, artillery, and planes. But the village below had somehow been spared. Either it was not hardcore VC, or the enemy had decided not to fight from the nearby trenches and bunkers, so the troops had not bothered to destroy it. The fields were being worked, and the people were moving back and forth along the paths to the long rows of huts. As we swept overhead, I had noticed that whole families were busy shelling and drying rice in front of the small mud and thatch houses. This is a familiar sight in Vietnam during the rice harvesting season. Everyone pitches in. Men, women, and children help pour the brown rice kernels from one round basket into another as they squat in the hard dirt patio in front of the huts. Old men with teeth stained red from betel nut quack like ducks in their high-pitched voices as their gnarled fingers rub the shells from the small grains of rice. The smaller children run in and out of the huts, sometimes playing hide-and-seek behind the trees, then running down to the paddies to splash about naked in the cool water. The plane circled two more times, and then the pilot's voice sounded over the intercom. "You know, I'm going to teach those folks a lesson. I'm calling for an airstrike." Having made the decision, he began calling for his radio operator stationed back at the airbase and ready to relay information to the central control headquarters. "This is Green Marker to Alpha." A young, tense voice acknowledged the message. "This is Alpha. Go ahead, Green Marker. Over." "This is Green Marker. I'm calling airstrike in a village down here where someone just shot at me. It was probably a 30 or 50 caliber weapon. Here are the coordinates of the village." The pilot read off the exact location of the area below. Then there were a few moments of silence as the operator cleared the strike through higher channels. "I sure don't like hitting villages, but they gotta learn to quit shooting at us," the pilot said over the intercom. Then the radio operator came back on. The strike had been cleared through. A call for jet bombers had been placed. "Probably take 15 to 20 minutes before we can get the planes," the operator said. Below, the villagers were unaware of the fate being organized for them. The jets would surprise them. They would appear on the horizon, dark and slim against the blue sky. There would be a primary pass for observation. Before the roar of the engine had settled across the village, the planes would do a climbing turn. Then they would level out and swoop in a neat arc towards the village. They would reach the bottom of the dive. Two bright silver cylinders would drop from the wings planes and drift towards the village. There would be a flash of brilliant orange and red, then a billow of smoke. Seconds later, the low whoomph of the explosion would echo through the air. Then, as the plane straightened for a second pass, the rubble of the huts would still be smoking. When it was over, only twisted trees and smoldering sticks would mark the spot where the village had stood. I had been through villages where this had happened. It was easy to imagine what it would be like in those huts below after the airstrike. After the wounded had been sorted out and placed in litters for the long hike to a Viet Cong camp or an American base, the dead would be prepared for burial. They would be placed in rough coffins, and the women would wail and cry, clawing at the coffins and spreading tears across the white, unpainted boards. The radio crackled again. It was a small stroke of luck for the village. "Sir," said Alpha, "there doesn't seem to be any planes available right now. However, there is an ARV and artillery battery within range. The pilot checked the map and located the Vietnamese artillery unit, which was located at the base of a small mountain 3 miles away. I guess we'll go ahead with that. Not the same as an airstrike, he muttered into the intercom. The pilot told the operator that he would call the artillery. Then, switching the frequency of the radio, he called the American advisor to the battery. The plane moved swiftly to the north to avoid the incoming shells as the artillery unit lined up its direction of fire. Suddenly, the artillery officer half whispered over the radio, "On the way over." The first round was short of the village. A spout of water leaped skyward as a shell exploded in a rice field. By now, the villagers realized what was happening. They had disappeared from the paths in the fields. The village became deserted as the browned-out hamlets we had seen earlier in the afternoon. What was a bustling village only 20 minutes before was now an empty series of brown huts and green fields. The pilot radioed corrections, and a few minutes later, the artillery officer said again, "On the way over." The second time, four shells landed simultaneously as the entire battery fired from the mountain base. Two rounds scored directly. A flash of fire and cloud of smoke rose up from the spot where a hut had stood. The other two shells burst in a nearby field. In the next 10 minutes, the artillery unit poured 35 rounds of high-explosive 105-millimeter shells into the village. Many of the shells exploded in nearby fields, but only three or four of the huts were spared. Finally, the pilot called over the radio. "Okay, that will do it." On the intercom, he muttered, "This ARV and artillery isn't worth a plane. With an airstrike, I could have put bombs within 20 feet of any spot in the village." When the artillery had finished, the pilot circled once more over the village. Then, in a final dive to 1,000 feet, he released two small rockets attached to the plane's wings. The small plane shuddered from the shock as the rockets were fired, then climbed steeply. "Hey, I got a haystack. No, two of them." Sure enough, each rocket hit a stack of dry brown grass, and both were burning brightly a few yards from a hut. As he started back from the airfield, the sun was beginning to settle across the distant mountains. The pilot called his radio operator. "How about running over to the mess hall and tell them to hold up something to eat? We'll be back in about 15 minutes. I sure am hungry," he added over the intercom. "I'm heartsick. The tragic black history which we are helping to write in Vietnam. And I'm terrified at the prospect that this brush fire war, as it's called, this nasty little war, is in real danger of becoming the most destructive and devastating war in all of our history." Secretary General added in his comments to the press just this week about the danger of the war spilling over its present boundaries. "The last 18 months have been a chronicle of escalation. Bit by bit, we have drawn the rest of Southeast Asia into this conflict. Bit by bit, we have drawn the world into this mass of destruction. 18 months ago, we began to bomb North Vietnam. And the North Vietnamese responded by increasing the rate of infiltration of supplies and men. About 18 months ago, we began to bomb North and South Vietnam from airfields in Thailand. And the Asians responded by increasing guerrilla activity against the Thai oligarchy. We have begun now to send in our military advisors to the Thai army to ferry their patrols into battle with our helicopters and our pilots, a program which is all too reminiscent of our program in Vietnam just 5-6 years ago. More recently, we bombed the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, breaking the fragile truce which held between the neutralists, the rightists, and the communists in that little country. And the Plain of Jars is today alight with gunfire, much as it was 10 years ago when it almost plunged the world into war. We have begun lobbing 105-millimeter artillery across a demilitarized zone. We have begun shelling the coast of North Vietnam from our destroyers and our cruisers. We'll bomb closer and closer to the population centers of Hanoi and Haiphong. We've mined some of the rivers and some of the harbors of North Vietnam. And the North Vietnamese have responded by increasing their mortar fire on the congested cities of South Vietnam. There is talk now of an invasion of North Vietnam, of search and kill activity into Cambodia, and of course the ever-present talk of the entrance of 800 million Chinese into this, quote, nasty little war. There is very real danger that from the eastern border of Burma to the South China Sea, a distance of 1,200 miles, an area 18 times the size of South Vietnam, there will be war, guerrilla war, dirty jungle war, a hapless, hopeless war for the United States. There are nearly a million men under American aegis in South Vietnam today. We have accepted almost 10,000 casualties of South Vietnamese military and civilians, some 300,000 dead, and we control today less than one half of that little country. Imagine the manpower. Imagine the cost, men and materials it would require. If we find ourselves in a war across the entirety of Southeast Asia, against an Asian people which will be united in opposition to the white man, to the Westerner, to the imperialist. And all this without imagining the cost to us if we manage to draw China into the conflict. Yet bit by bit, piece by piece, that non-policy, that anti-policy, which we call escalation, which is simply a frustrated response, bit by bit and piece by piece, escalation is making this land war across the breadth of Southeast Asia inevitable. The tragedy of South Vietnam is that it's pointless. Never, never from the very beginning has a vital interest in the United States been at stake. We got into South Vietnam because we like to meddle around the world. We like to police the world. But none of the basic vital interests of the United States are at stake in Southeast Asia. We've said it in our white papers and our State Department pronouncements. The tragedy of South Vietnam is that it's aimless. We have no policy. Escalation is not a policy, it's a response. And if I were asked, why are we fighting in Southeast Asia, I'm afraid the only answer I can give is that we are fighting because we don't know what else to do but fight. Do you remember some 6 years ago when the State Department was explaining to us why we ought to send the first men and the first materials to Southeast Asia? We were told that we had to protect a brave little people from communist subversion. We had to protect their freedom. What freedom were we protecting? Were the South Vietnamese people ever free of their oligarchs, their feudal overlords? All that we were really protecting in South Vietnam was the freedom of this feudal group. Those people had been exiled from the North because they had been the Quislings, they had been the compatriots of the French, was to allow them to continue in power over the peasantry, over the people. The freedom to run large landed estates and to collect feudal taxes. The freedom of the South Vietnamese people as opposed to the freedom of the clique in Saigon has never been in question. And we are still fighting for the freedom of the little clique that runs South Vietnam. I give you as evidence the reports of the last several weeks. The reports which come out of the Mekong Delta region, where we are, our troops are entering for the first time. And one report after another indicates that right behind our tanks and armored carriers and men overcome the landed gentility of Vietnam, to reclaim estates which had been cut up in Viet Cong land reform, try and get back taxes which the peasants had not paid now for several years. And this communist subversion that we were in South Vietnam to stop, history has shown and research has made us understand that this Viet Cong was not only a communist instrumentality, but it was an instrument of the Vietnamese people seeking to strike at the feudal hierarchy which imposed its heavy weight upon them. Oh, I know that there was a great communist cadre among the Viet Cong from the very beginning. But I would remind you that the Viet Cong, the nationalists of Vietnam, had no place else to turn but to the Chinese and to the Russians. In the last 10 years of the French rule in Vietnam, the United States had supported the French to the tune of 80% of their war budget against the nationalists. And I know that the Viet Cong used terror and murder in order to win its point. But I want to remind you that civil wars are notoriously the most cruel of all wars. Our own civil war is a classic example. For you are fighting for the control of your nation. There can be no retreat. Civil war is bloody and it is brutal. There is no gainsaying that. And I suspect that the United States would not have wanted to be in the position of pulling apart all brutal adversaries wherever they are opposed across the world. Now we wrapped political naivete in moral cant and we came up with a package which excused our involvement in Vietnam. We were there to protect the people's freedom. The people had never asked us to protect that freedom. We were there to protect them from communist subversion, a subversion they feared much less than the continued rule of the Diems. We were there really because of our own naive fear, our hypnotic fear of communist subversion around this world. We were still then, and many are still today, hypnotized by the idea that there is a united, organized communist conspiracy, and that every peasant rebellion which the communists managed to support around the world is part of that conspiracy, quite as much as the tanks and the planes of the Soviet Union. We forgot that Russia has its nationalist desires and China has its nationalistic desires. We forgot that the Russians and the Chinese can be at one another's throats quite as much as the East and the West. We forgot that the Vietnamese had for 1,000 years opposed and feared Chinese suzerainty. That Ho Chi Minh had requested in 1954 that observers be put on his northern boundary with China, even as we demanded observers be put on the 17th parallel between the two parts of Vietnam. We forgot the possibility, we overlooked the possibility that Vietnam might become an Asian Yugoslavia, a communist front state opposed to the great power bloc, which is, after all, that which the United States fears. Our policy was born in fear, misguided from the beginning, and has been magnified by frustration and miscalculation to this day. Now, there is really, of course, no reason to rehearse this well-known history. I believe that the vast majority of Americans are sick to death of this war. I believe that most of us would want to be out of it. The question is how. I rehearse this history because I believe it's important to recognize that our commitments in Vietnam were born of folly and made not between the American people and the Vietnamese people, but between an administration and a little clique. I believe that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And that commitments which are not basic commitments, vital commitments to a nation, are not commitments which one must hold on to with his every breath, as a bulldog holds on to the stick. I reject the president's argument of recent weeks that barring negotiations, successful negotiations, we must honor our commitments in Vietnam. The basic commitment of the United States must be to its own people. And our commitment in Vietnam is destructive, corrosive to the commitments of our wealth and of our strength to our own people. The war on poverty has been curtailed. The war on pollution, the war on urban blight, the war on congestion, all these have been pushed aside because of this stupid little war growing bigger. I reject the fact that military commitments made by a few in one administration to a few in another country must become the basic, visceral, life and death commitments of an entire nation until death do them part. America is frustrated. We do not want the war. The administration has talked of negotiation from the very beginning, but no negotiations seem on the horizons. Why not? In largest part because all of our talk about negotiations was pious, self-serving cant. We didn't mean what we said. We meant that if the enemy surrenders, we will go to a bargaining table and agree to allow them to work out the timetable of withdrawal for their troops and a withdrawal of our troops from South Vietnam. As long as we achieve our objectives, an independent South Vietnam under the present government of Saigon, the removal of the Viet Cong as an alien force from South Vietnam, as long as we achieve at the conference table what we cannot achieve on the battlefield, then we will go and we will negotiate and we will make peace. And the world rejected this proffer of negotiation, and Hanoi rejected it curtly. More recently, we seem to have become more eager for negotiation. This past week, we announced that we had immediately accepted Secretary General U Thant's proposal for initial negotiations. We seem to have broadened the base of our willingness to compromise. But there were some qualifications not spelled out because of Hanoi's rejection. And the speed of our acceptance of the Secretary General's proposal is in measure our confidence that it would be rejected by Hanoi. We were trying to gain a political victory rather than a significant negotiatory preliminary step. Why is there no peace? The answer lies in pride. We're a proud nation. We've been on the victorious side of the two great Holocaustal wars of the century. We believe ourselves above defeat. We believe that our military might can conquer all. We believe in what Senator Fulbright has called the arrogance of power. We believe that if we twist Ho Chi Minh's arm far enough, he will finally yell, "Uncle." We believe that if we kill enough Vietnamese, we will finally have our way. And the Vietnamese have pride. Pride in their nation, pride in their desire for independence of all imperialistic powers of the West, the pride of the Oriental against the white man who has abused him and held him in contempt low these centuries, the pride of a people whose homes have been destroyed by bombs, whose sons have been killed in war, whose children have been martyred, whose land has been scarred, the pride of a people who have nothing to lose but life itself. We're like two oxen butting heads. Neither will give. The one will accept death, the other refuses to accept a humbling. Hanoi insists that the hawk must each crow. Hanoi insists that this great nation of ours must bend the knee and make the first step towards disengagement. And we, frankly, cannot conceive of ourselves in such an awkward posture. And hence escalation, the mounting rate of death and devastation, hence the sense that all of us have that we are caught in the vice of history, that a magnet draws us on against our will to the precipice. What's for it then? I ask myself what military victory would mean. What would we achieve if the United States went ahead with all of our sophisticated weaponry and won a military victory in South Vietnam? I believe it to be possible. I believe that ultimately we can kill every able-bodied male among the Viet Cong above the age of 13. It's technically possible. What will we have achieved? How many men will it require to patrol the long borders of South Vietnam against the Asians who are united in their hatred of the West? Who will not let us have peace? How many millions will it require to take away the noxious chemicals we have spilt upon the fields and the forests and the trees? How many millions will it take to heal the broken bones and the wounded limbs, to educate the uneducated, to bring all the advantages of life into this nation? How many men? How much money? For how long? Victory in South Vietnam will mean, surely, an Asian war. The Asians will not allow us this victory. North Vietnam will not be crushed. They will continue to infiltrate, to battle. Now, of course, we can bomb North Vietnam to the grounds and presumably with a few millions of men destroy every North Vietnamese male above the age of 13. But what of the Cambodians? What of the people of Laos? What of all the peasants of South Vietnam, of Southeast Asia? And what of 800 million Chinese? Victory in Southeast Asia, I submit, means defeat. Military victory means an end to all that we are seeking to achieve there and here. Because if we really mean that our aim is the social reconstruction of Southeast Asia, you do not begin it by destroying this generation of Southeast Asians. And if we really mean that we want to improve the standard of life in the United States and to make war on poverty, you do not succeed in that by pouring your wealth into a jungle quagmire. Victory in Southeast Asia, I submit, is defeat. Possible technically, but politically impossible. All that we will achieve will be an endless war, endless bloodletting, endless bloodshed. What's for it then? Shall we twist the arm until it twists off? What will we have but a stump, a bloody limb? I submit that the only way to peace is for the United States to eat humble pie, to do that which we like least to do, to admit that we cannot have our way, that we cannot achieve militarily with all of our power some objective which was set out in the Pentagon some years ago. I mean by this that we will have to be the first to call off the airstrike, to pull back our troops into certain defensible redoubts, to bargain from weakness and rather than from strength, to plead with the Vietnamese to come with to the negotiating table rather than to insist they must come. It's not a pleasing prospect. But it's the only one which I know which offers us a scintilla of an opportunity for peace. We cannot make our way by force. A great nation finds it very difficult to humble itself before a small, oriental, relatively insignificant people. But what other alternative do we have? Is the battle worth the candle? And is not the measure of greatness in a nation its ability to take a look at itself and to pull back, to realize that the pride of the Vietnamese now is born out of a visceral need to maintain their very lives. American pride is only a matter of vanity. We made a mistake, a bad one. Let's admit it. We wasted American lives needlessly. Let's admit it. Everyone makes mistakes. Every nation makes mistakes. But let us not keep pouring men and materials, mistake after mistake, miscalculation after miscalculation, in the vain hope that we will somehow, by sheer power, achieve the objective, which the limited objective, which we say is ours from the very beginning. We can devastate Southeast Asia. We can bomb it. We can even in time destroy it with atomic bombs. But will China sit idly by? And will Russia? And is it really worth all of this? No one is quite sure why we're in this little nation, what we're doing there in the first place. Why not simply get out? I suppose that if the President of the United States were to make such a proposal, he would be defeated for a re-election. I think most in the United States have not come to that point where they are willing to recognize that we cannot always have it our way. But if Mr. Johnson would be defeated at the polls, and perhaps he would not be, he would have achieved immortality. For we would have brought this world to the brink of peace. He would have brought us from a war which is stupid and unnecessary to a peace which is full of potential and hopeful. And hopefully in the process, all Americans would have recognized that we cannot police the world. We cannot make the world dance to our tune. Much that will happen in this world will not be pleasing to us. This world is not a place where there are blacks of blacks and whites, communists and free, those who love freedom. It's a world of many colors and many shapes, and many varieties of hopes and programs. We're going to have to learn to live in that world as one nation among many, a great nation, but not the only nation. We're going to have to learn that the Oriental has pride, that he has hopes, that he has dreams, that he will achieve his future in his own way, with his own philosophies, not with ours and not in our own way. And that on all the guns and all the planes of this nation can make him toe our line. Whether it be war or whether it be peace, whether we continue in our pride or we swallow our pride, these next years are going to be difficult years for the nation. For Vietnam has divided this nation as I think this nation has never been divided before. It has brought confusion and uncertainty and doubt. There are those who are determined to persevere, who call traitor anyone who talks of peace. There are those who talk of peace who cannot see this flaunting of power. There will be bitterness and anger, slander, libel, name-calling. Political parties will be split apart. And during such a time, each of us is going to have to be steadfast in his democratic awareness. He's going to have to recognize that whatever be his views, there is an other view. That whatever be the decision ultimately, he must have sympathy with that decision. That we cannot allow this war to be divisive and fragment this nation to such a degree that it ceases to be one nation. If men wish to call the doves traitors, so be it. The dove is a sturdy little bird. It's a bird that likes its freedom. It's a bird that will be heard. I only pray that we will find in the weeks ahead the strength to be the great nation. By great, I mean the great spirited nation that America wants itself to be. That we will eschew the easy solutions, the solutions of escalation. That we will seek that solution which can bring peace. That when we talk of peace, we mean peace, and not simply scoring points in some battle of international propaganda. That we will think of the boys dying in a war which no one can really justify to them. That we will think of the Orientals, the Asian, dying in a war that they didn't ask for. That we will think of a nation being destroyed, its fields, its forests, its lands, its cities, and its people, destroyed by great powers using this war as a convenient battleground. That we will not set morality aside when we make our political decisions. Because America, if it is to be the nation that we love, is at base a moral nation. And our power is limited as much by the size of the world as by the spirit in which we were founded. Such a sermon as this is not easy to preach. One does not like to think of one's nation backing down, being wrong, humbling itself. But I know of no other alternative. And I pray desperately for peace. Amen.